Episode 52. If you've ever wondered if owning a brewery is really a ton of fun or just a whole bunch of chaos, then this episode is just for you as we take a behind-the-scenes look at Berkshire Brewing Company. Chaos happens. Here we choose to lead chaos rather than be led by chaos. We're sharing tips, resources, networks, and interviews that help you validate your ability to lead chaos and remain steady on. Are you ready to lead chaos? Let's do it. This is the Leading Chaos Podcast, and I am your host, Rhea Windcaller. Welcome to the show. I have on the show this week Gary Bogoff. He co-founded Berkshire Brewing Company in South Deerfield, Mass. With Chris Lally in 1994. Like many brewery owners, Gary's love of home brewing launched him into his current role at Berkshire Brewing Company as president and CEO. Gary, welcome to the Leading Chaos Podcast.
Thanks for having us.
Well, I was wondering, you know, with somebody in your role here, pretty busy at a big, giant brewery like this, how do you start out the morning? What do you have for breakfast?
Usually it's a cup of coffee and go.
Wow. Okay. Is there any food in there along the day?
Yeah, definitely. But I'm not a big eater in the morning.
Okay.
So it's usually a cup of coffee to get me powered up and then dive into the brewery and see what's there.
I think listeners will be a little disappointed that you're not starting with a beer to go, although I could understand the logic on that.
It's a long day most of the time, so I usually save my days and my beers for the end.
Great. And I do want the listeners to know that we're actually sitting here with a pint at the table here while I'm talking with Gary at his South Deerfield location, and we're trying a new special beer here, which is really delicious. So you might hear a little bit of the glasses moving around as we go along. Can you give us a sense of the size of the brewery, and especially for people who don't understand a brewery, what it is in terms of barrels and stuff, what you're producing?
Well, Berkshire Brewing Company has worked its way up to become a regional brewery, and a regional brewery is a brewery that sells over 15,000 barrels of beer a year. We achieved that back in 2002, I believe, right around there. When we started, there were less than 500 people in the country brewing beer. That was microbreweries, brew pubs, and the big guys. And 20-plus years later, there are now 3,500 breweries with another 1,500 or so still in the planning stage. So there's been quite a bit of growth in the industry. Out of the 3,500, we're in the top 135. So I look at us with a lot of humility, and we really are still a very small brewer in the stream of beer and capacity. We started off being able to brew 200 gallons or 7 barrels at a time, and now we've worked our way up to doing 20 to 25 barrel batches, about 650 to 700 gallons at a time. We usually brew 4 to 5 times a day, and on average we're doing about 20,000 barrels of beer a year. So that's about 40,000 kegs worth of beer.
And how many brewers do you have on staff here?
Normally we have about 6 brewers, and we do that so that everybody can rotate through the different parts of the process. We'd like all of our brewers to be cross-trained, so in case someone's on vacation or is ill and can't show up, we don't find ourselves with our hands tied demanding that, you know, one person do one thing. It also keeps everybody very active in the system, and we get a lot of good creative criticism and comments from the guys because they're all doing all the different jobs, so they all have a good feel for what's going on.
And so with all that going on, you have 6 brewers, you probably have how many overall working with the brewing company?
We are about 55 people now. Mm-hmm. We're somewhat different than the majority of craft brewers out there in the sense that we self-distribute. So we have our own delivery network for Massachusetts, Connecticut, and Rhode Island. And then in Maine, New Hampshire, and Vermont, we use a distributor network. So we actually have other wholesalers that sell our beer for us. But in our self-distribution network, we have salespeople, delivery people, and then our general administrative people.
Mm-hmm. And you said craft beer, and some folks don't realize that there is a distinction between craft beer and more, what would you call the other side? If it's not craft beer, what would it be called?
Well, to be kind, the American premium style beers where you have your mega breweries. But in all fairness to those guys, I mean, we have people like Sam Adams and Sierra Nevada and New Belgium that are really large brewers by comparison. But the craft, I think, is the word which kind of separates us from mainstream in the sense that you're looking at, you know, real wholesome ingredients, and craft is kind of loosening up in a sense where it used to be rehishkable across the board, and now it's acceptable to use a little bit of adjunct if you're making that particular style beer. Okay.
And so an adjunct, what do we mean by an adjunct?
An adjunct is an alternative form of grains to or cereals to create alcohol in the process. Corn and rice are two good examples of that. They're much cheaper than malted barley, which is the base for most craft beer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Now, this brewery was started in 1994, and I know a little bit of your history, and I should let the listeners know that I am the beer writer for this region, so I've known Gary for many years, and I've seen this business just flower and flower and flower and to the size it is, and I know that it takes a lot to run a brewery, not that I've run one, but just in speaking to all the brewers over the years and knowing you. And one of the things that I've heard always in the background about Berkshire Brewing is that there's a bit of controlled chaos. And, you know, everybody kind of chuckles when they say that, and I could kind of muster up my own thoughts on what that is, but what does that mean to you?
Well, I really think it's kind of more of a creative channeling than actual chaos. I mean, I think every organization has its moments, and I know personally I have my list of things that I set out to do every day, and if I get one of them done for the week, never mind the 10 that I have on my list every day, I feel like I'm accomplishing something, because not a minute goes by that there isn't a phone call that needs to be attended to, or someone doesn't walk through the door, or a driver's calling up, or a salesperson is calling up with an issue and or a problem. And I think our main motto is no problems, only solutions. So, I mean, we have a good positive attitude about the way we deal with what life throws at you on a day-to-day basis. There has been kind of, you could call it chaos in the sense of, you know, 20 plus years ago, craft brewing was in its infancy on the East Coast. And we started and saw that there was an ability to be successful, but we had no idea what success was going to be. And 20 years later, I know that I have a job that I come to work to every day, but the industry as a whole is changing in such a radical way that it's, you know, it's coming in and using your skills and your history to go forward. But there's no book that you can open up or no history that you can go back into that said, you know, when was the last time America had 3,500 breweries? And, you know, that was pre-Civil War, I think. So, you know, it's a new day and a new world, and we're doing our best to keep up with it and maintain, you know, number one, the quality of our beer is critical to our success, and that drives us. It's all about the beer, but beer's nothing without people. But then it's like, how do you deal with the marketplace? Because it's so interesting. I've been a board of director on the Mass Brewers Guild for about 5 years now. When we started in Mass, there were probably a dozen, maybe, breweries and pubs, and now there's over 116, and there are people that have opened up 5, 10 minutes from here that I've never even met yet. And when I go into the marketplace, they look at Berkshire as we're a juggernaut. And we're so far from that. From my point of view, when I look in the mirror, I see, you know, a good local little craft brewery that's just trying to do what they do best. I mean, to be looked at in that way by the new guys, you know, very complimentary, to say the least. But, you know, when we started, everybody shared the information and the knowledge. And if you needed a bag of hops or a bag of grain, you could call up the closest guy. And, you know, it was a very friendly, resourceful industry. And I think a lot of that still exists today, but it is getting so big that you just don't know everybody anymore.
So I'm kind of curious about that, because in your role, you make it sound simple. And I know you have this amazing work ethic. But I wonder, what do you do for yourself to, you know, you're the kind of guy who gets up, gets a coffee, and goes. I'm hearing you breathe right now. Is there any kind of tips for not just brewery owners, but any business person who is juggling so much and has this vision of quality? What do you do? What does Gary do for himself?
You when I'm not here? I enjoy what I do. I'm very fortunate. I think if you enjoy your work, you're probably one of the luckier people on the planet. And I love beer. That's what got me into it. And I really enjoy people a lot, too. So it's trying to mix those two. In one way, you know, being a part of a company and having certain responsibilities, you know, making sure that we don't hit the iceberg. The beer is actually the simple part, because it doesn't talk back to you. And if you want to change it, you do. And the people, on the other hand, I mean, that's the cosmic collision there. That's where, you know, somebody wakes up on the wrong side of the bed, or something's happening, and they end up bringing their work in there with them, or they're just having a bad day, or they're having a good day. But the thing is, you know, I respect everybody who works with me. It's you know, once upon a time, if somebody told me to go screw, I just work a few hours longer. And now we've created a monster that if everybody isn't pulling their weight and doing their job, then things can go awry and other people have to carry the load. So, you know, it's trying to have a nice balance where people feel good about where they're working and what they're doing. When we started off, we didn't even have a hand truck here. The first couple of loads of grain came off the trailer one bag at a time over our shoulders. And as we grew, we, you know, started getting the equipment that made the quality of life a lot better. I mean, it's still work. That's why they call it work. Mm-hmm. But, you know, the guys and gals who are working here now have all the tools that we dreamed about when we started. But it's really trying to keep everybody happy, knowing that they're all part of a team, knowing that they're all essential to the whole process.
Is it lonely on top? Not as terms of Berkshire Brewing being on the juggernaut, or, you know, that way, but in your role as a president and CEO, is that a lonely position?
It's a great Randy Newman tune, one of my favorites, and I just want to be part of the gang, and my biggest problem is that I'm on a need-to-know basis, and a lot of times the employees think I need to know or don't need to know something, and I end up finding out about everything just how long it takes for it to disseminate down or up, so to speak. But it's tough being at the top of any business, because I think the American employee I think managers have been typecast that, you know, if you're working through the pyramid system, the more towards the bottom you get, I think you think the people above you are different than you are. And the reality is that there isn't anything in this brewery that I personally haven't done before I would ask anybody else to do it. And you know, I have not forgotten where I came from, and I think that's essential for, you know, being the captain of a ship. You know, you got to be the first one at the scene and the last one to leave. Mm-hmm. So,
and I think that's kind of unique to a lot of breweries in terms of a business world and managing that chaos, is that a lot of brewers do kind of come up, you know, cleaning the mash out and cleaning the barrels and bottling the beer and all that. And it's rare in most cases that people come in without that background. So would you say that really helped you, knowing all that?
Well, it does. When Chris and I put this together, we basically built our own system. And it was just a big homebrew system, what we were doing. And last April, I went to the craft beer conference out in Portland, and they had a trade show that filled up like 2 or 3 football fields. And there had to be, if there was one guy, there were 100 guys who were fabricators. And it was like going down the car alley in your town where all the different models and makes are there, and you basically walk into the showroom and you tell them, I want that model with those bells and those whistles, and everything comes to you all brand new and shiny. And the crew that I grew up with in this industry were, you know, guys like Grossman, who, you know, we used dairy tanks and made things work for us. I mean, we, you know, it was always expensive. It's killer crazy out there now. But, you know, we made existing things work for us. Mm-hmm. And that was essential to move forward.
So is that part of your roots, too? And when Gary's talking about dairy tanks, he's talking about these milk tanks that you had gotten from farms, correct?
Yep.
Like 300-gallon tanks. And the floor outside of here, and I'm going to be taking some photos of this and putting it up on the show notes for this episode so you could see that. But there's still one milk tank out on the floor, just one, right?
Right, a 14-barrel.
Yeah. Right, and 14 barrels would be...
Yeah, about 500-gallon tank.
500-gallon tank. And now, where there used to be all these, like, 14-barrel tanks, there's these giant
100-barrel squares. I mean, we do all open fermentation here at Berkshire. Most breweries are doing closed fermentation.
Can you say what that means? Don't know what that means.
Open fermentation is where the tanks are literally open to the environment. They're not pressure rated. They're not encapsulated. So the beer, basically, it's like if you are a home brewer, it's a carboy without a top. And so there's no airlock, and you really have to, sanitation is key to any brewing process. But the characteristics of what we found of open fermentation is that you get a much cleaner product because all the gases and byproducts that are created during the fermentation process actually vent versus being entrapped in the tank.
And you're utilizing some of the natural yeast in the air?
No, we're not doing spontaneous fermentation. But when we do brew, it goes into open vessels, and it's imperative that, you know, things are sanitized prior to our introduction of our wort. Mm-hmm. And we use billions of yeast cells to beat the natural guys back. Mm-hmm. So we basically dominate who's going to win in the tank.
Right. So you're kind of controlling the chaos that could happen with yeast, because as I know beer, yeast, if you did have a totally open spontaneous fermentation, the yeast in just floating around the air would take over.
Yeah, there's basically that would be like a goose or a lambic, and those are spontaneously fermented with what's in the air, and there's over 60 different wild flora and fauna and yeast strains that, you know, can contribute to that type of fermentation.
So there's a lot going on in a brewery besides just the beer, which you're making sound really easy, but at the same time, sanitation is really important, and the team that you have behind you is really important, and managing all that and having it work so it's truly a team, so that you're progressing forward, is key. You're making it sound easy, and I
I'm going to just kind of try to get back to this question again, because I wonder, you know, some managers, some CEOs, they go running, they go golfing, they go fishing, they go on a retreat. Is there any way that you take care of yourself in that way, or you would recommend for people to think about in that role? That's work for you.
I should be doing all of the above. And I really should. But I do spend a lot of time here. I mean, the brewery is kind of my baby, and you know, I've watched it grow, and I really get a lot of joy from being here and seeing, you know, what's happened over 20 years. I enjoy coming in here on the weekend when nobody's here and just listening to the hum and of the pumps and, you know, what's going on in the background. And I was fortunate that I came from a building contractor background, so I've pretty much had my hands in everything that's gone on here, from the actual concrete to placing the equipment to, you know, pulling wire and mm-hmm. pipe and whatever else needed to be done. So it's kind of like part of me, and it is, it's a very calming place for me. Sometimes things are spinning, but most of the time it's a pretty good place.
Nice. Now, the future looks kind of bright, because I know that MGM Casino in downtown Springfield, Massachusetts, is going to be building a casino there, and Berkshire Brewing is going to be supplying the beer. Is that correct?
Well, we've been in discussion with them. That is the concept that they're purveying. We would certainly want to be part of that. They're right now ran into a little bit of a setback with the highway down there, so it's going to be another year, but we are in communication with them. We brought them out to Four Star Farm up in Northfield, and they met Gene and everybody. And
that's a hop growing hop, farm.
Right, yeah. And they want to support the local economy, whether it be things that they buy or things that can be grown and used. So mm-hmm. we've talked about different concepts of maybe brewing them their own beer, but it's that's still a way off.
Work in progress.
There's been some very exciting things, though, that have happened this year. One is the advent of 12-pack in cans, and we're getting into 12-ounce glass, which actually hit the market in Western Mass this week. So we're very excited about that. And most of the chaos actually comes on the packaging side of brewing, and I don't think people understand, you know, they have the stars in their eyes that they're going to be brewers, and they have that passion for the beer, but then it's like, well, what are you going to do with all that beer? And somehow it's got to be put into something to be moved out of the brewery, and that is almost a separate industry unto itself, and it's much more complicated than the brewing.
Now, this Berkshire Brewing Company originally was going to be draft, and then you realize, and that means that it would be distributed out to bars and people would have it on tap. And then I think you and Chris soon realized that that wasn't the best of choices to do exactly what you're talking about, to handle all that beer.
Well, 20 years ago, most bars had four taps, and they had everything you needed, Bud Light, and Miller, and Coors. Mm-hmm. And it wasn't really until the turn of the century that, you know, microbreweries really started having an input and impact, and people started expanding their draft lines. And now, you know, it's not uncommon for the good beer bars to have anywhere from 10 to 20, 30 lines, but, you know, now there's 3,000 breweries, so the competition for those lines is just as intense as it was when there were only the four. So it basically, we realized back then, you know, most business is relationships, and you can't take that away from people. So we had to break into the market and make some friends before our draft actually caught on. So it was about 6 years before draft really started being a big cornerstone for Berkshire. In the meantime, we didn't have any money for bottling, So we put together a couple of picnic coolers and started filling bottles using our hand capper from our home brewing. And
used to have people come in, too, and help with that. Is that right?
That's
Wasn't there
correct.
Like a whole program around bottling?
We had the A-team.
Ah.
And we had a couple of retired guys. And they'd came in religiously every week and worked for lunch, some beer, and a case to take home. And as it kept spreading, we started getting a lot of kids from UMass, and people would come and stay for a couple of weeks and move on. And it was reality before the age of reality TV. I wish we had a couple of videos of that, because some really wild and great people came through the brewery. And it was like a great marketing. It was guerrilla marketing. And everybody had a great experience. And they took it away with them and told their friends. And their friends came. And pretty much that's how we marketed for the first 10 years of our process.
And I think it moved on from the draft to these 22-ounce bottles, or what is known in the beer world as bombers. And they're, you know, larger than the average size bottle. And that's kind of ubiquitous to Berkshire Brewing. It was the only beer that you would see in those very large bottles. And that was a standard for everybody to have refrigerated. Your refrigerator would be filled with a steel rail pale ale in your big old bomber there. I'm kind of wondering, if you were to go back 24 years ago and have that ability to speak to Gary back then in 1994, what would you say to him?
You know, all things considered, from a starting capital point of view, and I mean, if all that stuff was the same, the only thing I'd tell him would be, don't have any investors. Go to the bank, get your money, pay the bank back, and everything you have is yours. Because having investors is like having additional partners, and everybody knows a better way to do it. And you're not just going to work for yourself every day. You're going to work for another interested party, or disinterested, or, you know, they don't really quite understand the whole 360 of it.
Right, right. And starting a brewery in 94, probably a little, the inflation rate and all that, does it really meet where we are now in 2015? A lot of money to go out and to go to that bank, and now in this day and age.
Well, I mean, I look back at what we started with, and, you know, I think we probably had about $150,000 that we did the whole renovation, bought our starting equipment, and started selling beer. And out there today, I see these folks, and I mean, even if they're putting in a small 7 or 10 barrel system, they're probably dropping $1.5 million. So it's probably 10 times what it was back then. And honestly, I don't know how people can become part of the marketplace, because I see chaos in the marketplace. It's very difficult. There's no brand loyalty anymore. When we grew up, our big thing was to having to educate our customer base to understand that there was something other than monosyllabic beer. And now, you know, we've got a generation hitting the legal drinking age who've seen craft beer in their parents' refrigerator their whole life growing up, so it's nothing new to them. And there's this really interesting curiosity that abounds, where they all want to try something new. And it's, I feel bad for the person who goes to a bar, finds a beer they like, and then they go back next week to have another pint and they can't find it, because the bar owners feel that they have to put something new on every time. And there's no real baseline out there anymore. And I don't know if that's part of the pendulum swing, or how long that's going to last. Mm-hmm. But it's an interesting marketplace.
Yeah, it is interesting. Imagine for the brewers, it makes you have to keep on moving forward in a direction that, you know, it's just you playing to the market versus playing to the beer and the palate.
You brought up a very interesting concept because, and I was talking to John Corpita from Amherst Brewing, and back 20, 25 years ago, people who liked beer knew that there were other things than American beer. I mean, the world looked at America as we were drinking swill. And so when home brewing became legal, there was this want to go out and try to replicate those great traditional beers from around the world and to be able to brew, you know, a good authentic Pilsner or a great pale ale or a traditional IPA or a Dunkel or any of these beers that were known, that was what it was all about, so that we could drink those great styles and be able to replicate them and even go forward and improve on them, and we did it here. And now it's almost like people have forgotten that beer is a tradition in the sense of, you know, beer should be a relaxing experience, and it shouldn't be overwhelming. It should be where you can sit down with a stranger and have a pint and become a friend. And, you know, now some of the things, and I'm not criticizing the creativity, but, you know, lemon, lime, watermelon, Ricky flavored beer, I guess it's fine for some people, but what about those good traditional styles of beer? You know, can you go out? Is anybody even brewing a good Oktoberfest anymore, or has everybody gone to pumpkin? And you know, it's like I can see the evolution, and there's certainly nothing wrong with that, but I don't think I think that the old tradition is being discarded, and to say what is a good beer, you know, I think you really have to go back to be able to compare it to what existed in the Czech Republic or in Bamberg, Germany for a smoked beer or, you know.
Yeah, well said. And I think that's going to, as you said, it remains to be seen how that plays out, especially since craft beer is everywhere now. And the public is educated in a different way than it was back in 94, where folks were just a pale ale. They didn't even know what an IPA was.
Right.
And now I imagine you have a number of different experimental beers happening here at any given day that you're looking for the future.
We are, and that's what the marketplace is demanding.
That's probably not such a bad thing because it kind of keeps you on your toes, and you also get to create your brand in a certain way, which is part of business too, right?
It is, and I know, you know, we're probably later coming into this fad, but I don't think, you know, if you were to get together with a bunch of brewers to talk about how expensive and complicated it is to come up with something new all the time, you know, you're dealing with the federal government for one, they're very, very busy and very backed up, and so to get a beer to market, it probably takes 6 months, 4 to 6 months. You know, between you getting your name authorized and your label authorized and going to the printer and, you know, getting it all done. Mm-hmm. And it's really an expensive, time-consuming proposition.
Yeah. Well, I think that you wear these hats well of the many different levels here, both as a president and CEO, but kind of holding the family that surrounds Berkshire Brewing. I think you do, from my vantage, I'm a little biased. I think you do that really well, and I think the taste is reflected in the beer that your company here makes.
Thank you.
I'd like to just let the listeners know how they would be able to get in touch with Berkshire Brewing Company, and you are online. It would be berkshirebrewingcompany.com. There is their website, and you can also find them on Facebook. You just kind of Google Berkshire Brewing Company Facebook, and they do have a Twitter feed, which is at Berkshire Beer, or Berkshire Brew, I apologize. And we will have these links to all these online social media places that you could get this info on this company here on our show notes. Gary, I really appreciate you providing some insight today and sharing some of your time and of course, some of your beer, which is delicious as always.
Thank you.
And being part of this Leading Chaos podcast episode.
Well, I'd like to thank you and your listeners, and definitely you for being out in the field year after year and keeping the network a network. You know, the people in Boston think the world ends at 128, and if it wasn't for you reporting as you do, nobody would know that Western Mass even exists. So thank you very much.
My pleasure. Thank you.
That was a pre-recorded interview with Gary Bogoff of Berkshire Brewing Company in South Deerfield, Massachusetts. And I want to make a correction. During the interview, I mentioned the Twitter feed, and it is actually at Berkshire Brew Company. So it's at Berkshire Brew Co. And you could follow them on Twitter. You could also follow this podcast on Twitter, and that feed is at Leading Chaos. Meanwhile, next week we have the interview with David Schreiner Kahn coming up, and that will be the tribute to September 11th. It is going to be the 14-year anniversary of the events of September 11th that changed so many people's lives, and I like to commemorate that. And it is an amazing story of a father's love for his daughter and also his eyewitness account in New York City of the World Trade Center. So do subscribe to this podcast via iTunes, and you'll get it directly delivered to your smartphone each week as we move forward. This is Rio Windcaller signing off for now. Let's all see if we could brew a little calm chaos our way as the week progresses. Please be kind, be safe, and take care of each other. Ciao for now.